This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
This is episode 123, I just noticed.
Aww.
While writing down the episode, 123.
Why didn't we do one on Sesame Street to celebrate?
Do you think we'll make it to episode 1, 2, 3, 4?
Do I think we'll make it to episode 1? This is kind of like the Imagine Millionaire as a time concept. I need to try and figure out how long it'll take for us to, like, we'll be if we do it every 2 weeks, will we still be alive for episode 1, 2, 3, 4?
Well, what do you think?
I guess we'll be old.
Let's figure it out.
I'm hedging all my bets here. I'm like a stockbroker with GameStop. I'm not sure.
So 1,234, and let's say this is what episode 123. So we'll subtract them two, and that'll give us what we have. So that's 1,111 episodes to get to 1, 2, 3, 4, right? And so then
divide that by 2, and then divide that by 52. No, that's wrong. Oh shit!
Wait, no. Multiply it by 2.
Why?
Because that's how.
I actually have a really complicated maths course as part of my master's this year, and this is how I approach every weekly task. This math course is taught by many-time guest of this show, Donal Mulligan.
Yeah, he's cringing right now. No, we multiply it by 2 because it's.
Because why?
Because 2 is a cool number. Oh, this is our science episode. So we need to here's what we do. Okay, we need to record 1,111 podcasts to get to episode 1, 2, 3, 4, right?
Yes, every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks. So multiply that times 14 to get how many days?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
So let me do that now.
I think you've chosen the most complicated and unsure way to get there, but okay.
No, we'll get there. 1,111, that's what I said, times 14 equals, okay, 15,554. Right.
Divide that by how many days in a year. So
365 equals 42. Okay, 42 years.
42 years. Be pushing it. Like, even you've joined us in the third decade.
Yeah, so I'd be 72. Jesus.
And I'd be 98.
We'd still, what?
I'm not good with math.
Look how long it's after taking us to, took us three, almost 4 minutes to work all this out.
And welcome to What Am Politics, What Am Vaccine / Science episode.
You can trust us when it comes to smart stuff.
Nuh-uh, that's why we're taking in guests. We couldn't have written that if we tried.
I'm so embarrassed.
This is how I feel every week trying to do Donald's tasks.
Yeah, Jesus. Look, this is a dummy's guide for politics and fucking counting.
What am 1, 2, 3? We don't know. No.
What's that alphabet that's made of numbers?
We're wordy men. We're lyrical. We like to elaborate using syllables, not words.
Yeah, we've rich tapestries with our guests' words, and we nod.
Yeah,
while drool comes out of our mouths. Oh, but what is What Am, Steve? So no, yeah, that's our contribution. But what is What Am, Steve?
Luckily, it is not a science or mathematics show. This is a politics show that we approach from a very flimsy point of view.
Flimsy is a word, an accurate one. Yeah, flimsy, irreverent.
Yeah, look, if you want hard-hitting, fast-acting, deeply complicated political knowledge,
then watch Sesame Street.
Watch, or even Numbers, then you can listen to 538. But like, this is where you go to understand politics as it should be understood.
Mm.
A big load of madness.
It's a silly subject with silly people in it, including us. And if you want more silliness, you can become a Head Stuff Plus member and get access to some of our bonus episodes. There's a link to that in the show notes.
They are 2/3 silly, 1/3 serious.
Is that more maths, Steve? Is that more numbers you're trying to work in?
Hey, look, I did that one okay. Don't fucking make me doubt myself already.
Yeah.
I can count to 3. That's implicit. 1, 2, 3. Don't ask what comes next.
Yeah. So yeah, you can check that out if you want. Steve, before we get too much into our episode today, I have like a bit of a conundrum. So you can see I'm recording next to this big window.
Very bright.
Accidentally left the window open. Now the room's all cold. And so to counteract that, I was thinking I could use this big inefficient heater from the 1970s.
Oh yeah.
That plugs in, is very electricity inefficient. So I was thinking rather than close the window, I could just plug in this very resource consuming heating device, and that would just balance it out.
That's like,
this isn't, by the way, this isn't just like me adding in sound effects. This is an actual literal heating device from
I don't know. I don't know. Do these things exist outside of Ireland? They're just like, it's like we captured the idea of flame and put it on to a piece of, it's like a toaster.
It is like a toaster.
It's like a hyped up toaster.
It's like toasters like deadbeat dad. He just like comes into town like once a year looking for money. But anyway, that's what I was thinking of doing. Do you think that makes sense?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you're going to have one side hot, one side cold. That can't be bad for you.
Do you think the folks over at the 180 Degrees podcast would agree?
Probably not, no. They probably have better advice to give people.
Yeah, so maybe people should go listen to that. This is, if you listen to our last episode, you're aware we've got like a bit of a paid partnership going with the folks over at 180 Degrees, a podcast by Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland.
S-E-A-I.
There you go. They're probably filled with a lot more wisdom than, you know, using dangerous heaters from dangerous toasters to heat your cold room.
Yes,
because your window's left open.
They'll tell you about how to insulate things and get better windows and all those kind of things. But they're going to be talking to people, asking those questions, sharing stories of people across Ireland working towards a cleaner energy future, much more efficient than what we're proposing.
They hear how businesses and public sector bodies are cutting out carbon emissions and how energy research is informing policy decisions.
Research, Richie, not just lifting something up, hitting it and asking your buddy.
Oh.
Well, I mean, that's one form of research.
Yeah. 180 Degrees is brought to you by Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland, as we discussed, and it's supported by the Government of Ireland. So there they are, doing something right. So what are we going to talk about this week, Steve?
Well, we're going to broadly talk about vaccines. You know, them things that we all need to get back to normality.
Yeah, it's all anyone can talk about.
It's actually, I'm kind of glad when we talk directly about COVID for a while every so often in the news, because I'm quite tired of talking about vaccines.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, I also need to hear from people who know what they're talking about, not just making shit up.
That's it. There's a lot of people making a lot of shit up, which isn't a new thing, it turns out.
No.
Which I'm sure, we'll learn more about. You always think these things are like modern inventions, but I was recently reminded that...
You mean bullshit or vaccines?
No, both. But I mean like the idea of bullshit. Like, you know, we have modern terminology like, you know, fake news and, you know, post-truth and all these... recent labels that we put on things. But I saw, I was reminded of like early 90s tabloid sensationalism. Yeah. When I saw a screenshot of, or like a picture of a newspaper that said Hillary Clinton's secret alien baby.
Yeah. I mean, you can go back in the archives and check out the episode on fake news that we did with Valerie Loftus in Electric Picnic, where we talked about all that stuff. And we had a slideshow. So there'll be links to that in that episode show notes.
It's like fake moon, bad alien people.
Fake moon, bad alien people. I mean, yet to be disproven.
That's true. Have you been to the moon? I haven't.
I haven't. Nobody has.
Oh God, no, we are...
This is how we're introducing...
This is introducing our science episode by being moon landing deniers. No, the moon is very much there.
Made of cheese. Well,
yeah, made of cheese, like we all know. No, exactly. We want to talk about vaccines. And we want to talk about... Like, we have an episode list that we, you know, want to tackle over a time doing this show. And one of the subjects was science. Even though that's big and broad. Luke O'Neill has been like on our wanted list for a long time. And the conversation of like vaccines felt like a really natural way of getting into the idea of science as a whole and how it intersects with politics.
Yeah.
And Luke's been doing a lot of talking about vaccines recently.
He really has. He's become very prominent on Irish media. Listeners from outside of Ireland might not know him much, but if you're inside Ireland, I'm pretty much sure that you would have come across him. He has been working his arse off to try and educate people about science and immunology and viruses and all those things that are quite important for the last year.
Yeah, and like he's got the credentials to back it up. He's a professor, he's a scientist, he's an author, he's a professor of biochemistry and immunology in Trinity College Dublin. So you know, very big deal.
Very big
deal. Too big for us.
I think he's the highest ranking academic we've had on the show so far.
Really?
Yeah.
Should make him a dull fight.
Yeah.
That's what academia is all about.
Isn't it? Just fight. Yeah. Knife fights in the dark.
Yeah, exactly. No, he's legit and he's great. And let's hear what he has to say.
Mind you, lads, I have to work on my book. I'm doing a new book at the moment.
Are you?
Gail have commissioned another book, given that the other went sold quite well for them. It's my diary through Corona Coaster, beginning on the 6th of January.
Jesus.
When I first read about the virus, you know?
Yeah.
And then my own sort of journey with my lab and the research, and also then an account of what's happened, basically, scientifically, you know?
Fascinating. Didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's two copies of the other book in this house because so many people were getting it as Christmas presents, like in the household when you combine them, then we ended up with two.
Superb. Yeah.
Delighted with that, Luke.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I wrote it, it's a funny when you're happy just to write the damn thing for yourself almost. You know, and it looks quite nice and you have it in your hand. And then I was thinking if a few thousand people buy it, that'll be good enough, I suppose. But then, for obvious reasons, it went through the roof, you see. So it's gone pretty well.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that, actually, and just get into it, because the whole world is talking about, you know, vaccines and science broadly nonstop. And do you feel like a cool hipster who was way into the subject before everyone else thought it was cool? And now everyone's just catching up to you?
That's a good question. I don't think I feel like a cool hipster. I certainly feel like delighted that people appreciate it. Let's put it that way, you know, because we always knew how important it was as an activity and we knew how important medical research was and all kinds of things, you know. And all that's happened really now is people are much more engaged. I mean, I would be telling this stuff for years to people and like the eyes would glaze over after 2 minutes kind of thing. But now they're on, yeah, tell me more about that. What's going on here, you know. So it certainly galvanized people's interests for obvious reasons. And then the good thing is they're realizing how powerful science is really, you know, and how much of a contribution it makes to our lives. And then there would have been a bad press about, say, big pharma and stuff, you know. It wasn't always positive, was it? Mm. But this is sort of revealing from a scientist anyway, that science is really a brilliant thing. And without science, we wouldn't be able to get through this at all. Well, we would eventually if it was medieval times, but science is the way out clearly. So that's the good part of all this.
Yeah, and I mean, you've spent a lot of time thinking of clever analogies and little bits about the tidbits and history from vaccines as well. I mean, you've got a whole chapter about it in the book, and then I think you've done a good few appearances on shows and your own podcast as well talking about it. So just for our own listeners, would you have kind of some analogies that would be like help people get their head around how vaccines work?
And I would.
How we're going to get out of this.
Keep reinventing them. And they're getting better all the time.
Fully refined.
But geez, that mightn't be the case. I could be getting them a bit too complicated. But the immune system is the biggest analogy of all is the immune system is your army of defenders, because you get infected with a virus or a bacteria. They are bad guys. And we evolved a very elaborate set of troops to fight them. So you start with that. It's always a military kind of analogy, you know. And then the infection goes in. Simply enough, the troops come out. There's different types of troops. It's very, very complicated, actually. When I began studying immunology about 35 years ago, our knowledge has grown and grown exponentially. A good analogy I used was if it printed out all the knowledge in immunology, say when I began my research in the mid-80s, you might print out about this much paper, you know. Now it's as high as a mountain because of all this knowledge that's been acquired through science over that time. And of course, we can use that science now to great effect here. So all those cells, all those molecules, things called antibodies, things called cytokines, they're words people have heard of now. But the way a vaccine works is actually quite straightforward. You want to give a form of the bad guy that won't damage you and won't make you sick, but allow the immune system to recognize the real bad guy when he comes along. And that's exactly how they work. So for example, in the case of COVID, it's the spike protein, that piece of the virus is injected into you. And your immune system recognizes the spike. And then when the real bad guy comes along covered in spikes, he can be recognized and immediately eliminated, you know. And then there's different types of vaccines. I'll give you another analogy I got last week, which I was quite happy with. So imagine there's two towns beside each other. And there's a bad family in one of the towns. And we're frightened of them, right? How do we train the sheriff and the cowboys to recognize that bad family, okay? We might sneak into the town and grab one of them and kill him and bring him back to our town and then show him to the sheriffs. Then the wanted posters goes up. They're called attenuated vaccines. The Sinopharm vaccine is the whole dead guy, okay? A second thing is We sneak in and we rob one of his hats. No, they're all wearing the same hat, like a black hat.
Yeah.
We bring that back to our town. We show all the troops, there's the black hat. We make a poster with the black hat on it. And now the bad guy arrives with the black hat and he can be arrested and put in jail. That's the spike. See, the black hat is like the spike from the virus. And these are very safe because they aren't the live virus.
Sure.
They're parts of the virus. So in essence, that's what the vaccines do. And then the last thing to say is what's incredible about the immune system is it remembers. The sheriff doesn't forget, you know, he can remember for years. And in fact, that's these memory B cells and memory, they're called memory cells. They're in your bone marrow and in your spleen and your lymph nodes getting ready. And if the bad guy arrives again, they remember him, you know, and then they can fight him. That's the question of how long vaccines last, for instance. That's all about that memory response. How long can the cells be sustained for, I suppose. So that'll give you a quick one. I wrote that in the Sunday Independent and a neighbor of mine literally brought me a black cowboy hat with the bad guy stuck on it. And he gave it to me as a gift. Isn't that lovely?
That's great.
I have it in my hand. Well, he said to me, Luke, I got it at last. That black hat analogy really, really explained it to me. And he was very grateful. You know?
So to take that analogy a little bit further, with all the talk of new variants and whatnot, is that kind of like the bad guys, you know, they go from wearing black cowboy hats to those multicolored ones, the propeller on propellers on them.
Precisely. Yeah. Exactly. The hat changes.
Yeah.
And now the sheriff can't recognize them. Now, luckily at the moment, the changes are there, but they're not that extensive. You can see it's a bit smudged. Let's put it that way, you know. So the sheriff isn't quite as good as recognizing it, but still it's the limit. So the efficacy goes down a bit because of those variants. Mm. And in fact, what happens as well, by the way, is very often what the immune system does is when the immune system is vaccinated, you make loads of sheriffs, millions of them, you know. And you have a numbers game now. And even though the quality might go down of the sheriff, he's not as competent as he was, because he's just able to recognize the smudged hat. There's many more of them to jump on the bad guy, you know. So and this isn't a bad analogy. There are more antibodies.
Yeah.
They may be less effective, but they'll still eliminate that bad guy when he arrives. So that's now the big worry would be though the hat will change completely, and then they won't recognize it at all. And that's called escape. This happens in immunology. They're called escape mutants. Now, we're looking out for those very carefully. There's a risk of them coming, but it's unlikely. It turns out it takes quite a while to change the hat. It's a slow process. Mm. Now, it has happened, and we think it's happened a bit quicker than we thought, to be honest. I'm not quite sure why that is. It looks as if the reason why it's happened is someone who is very immunosuppressed, the virus got into that person's body and began to make loads of copies because it's all random. Every time the bad guy has a baby, if you will, he's slightly different to the father or mother, you know, and there's these tiny, and eventually the hat's a bit different, you see. So, but that's a very slow process. But we think this probably came from someone who was immunocompromised. And what that meant was the virus was able to live for months in that person's body, generate loads of offspring, and just dumb luck then one of them became slightly different, you know. The second thing I read yesterday though, or 2 days ago, was one of the therapies for this disease is they give people antibodies. Now, as you may know, the immune system makes antibodies. They lock onto the virus and eliminate it, but of course you can use antibodies as a therapy. And they reckon it might have grown in someone who was given antibodies because through natural selection, randomness, maybe one virus could dodge the antibody. So in other words, what we call selective pressure was put on the virus, which sped up, you know, the one that might escape and become the one that's not recognized by the antibody. That may be where these have come from. That's useful information because they should stop giving people those antibodies now as a therapy.
Oh, really?
Because it might encourage other variants to come along, you know?
Sure, right. Yeah. So you gave us a little, you gave us an idea that this diary book is coming where you've been writing about what has happened since about this time last year. But then to give us a little spoiler, maybe, where are you expecting us to be able to develop the vaccine so quickly? Because I guess that's what everyone is quite astounded by, is that within a year we now have so many different types of vaccines that all seem to be quite effective. I mean, even the Sputnik one, the Russian one, people were surprised to see is like 95% effective. Where are you surprised that the scientific industries are able to turn around so much?
I was more delighted to see how quick it happened. I knew it would happen. I mean, there's no question they're going to get there, but it's a slow enough process. And previous vaccines took longer to make, and
sure,
you know, there's always a risk of something going wrong. It's a very complicated thing to do, you see. So if we go back to say April, May time, I would say I'm probably a year from then, maybe. You know, that kind of time frame was a reasonable one to guess that all the trials have to be. Remember, these trials had 40,000 people in them, and that's a logistical. So the huge effort to get that done, just stuff on the ground is difficult, you know, in terms of timing.
they had to actually swap where they were going to do them, because Europe and some parts of the US had gotten pretty effective at suppressing the virus. So they had to move them to places like Brazil and South Africa, where there were more infected people.
Exactly. Yeah. In other words, there's no point vaccinating people if there's no virus around, you know. So, and there was all those logistics and everything. And of course, what happened then that made push that forward was money was put into it, because it is a money game. And Operation Warp Speed in America, for example, the EU put loads of money in and they gave the companies a huge amount of cash. Now, what that meant was they could recruit more people to run the trial. They could build bigger factories to help them do the thing. And whatever it is, you know, resources were pumped into this. And that's why they could go fast. It wasn't because they took any shortcuts, by the way, which is a big worry people have, I know. But that wasn't the case. They could just put more resources in. Like, the good analogy there, which I always like, is if you get one fella to paint your house, it might take him a week. Get 100 guys, it's done in an hour. You know, it's quite similar to that. It's literally just people with their hands in factories doing things. You know, this is what counts for this thing. And that's why it went so fast. So we were all delighted in the end that November was the signature day. In my book, there'll be a little, I don't know what it is, the page we colored red or something. The red letter days, that was one. You know, I remember in early November when Pfizer announced their results, we were all delighted. Because now we were delighted for two reasons. First of all, there's now a vaccine. But secondly, we can beat this with a vaccine. There was always a question, maybe this virus would be difficult to vaccinate against. We didn't know, you know.
Yeah.
So that was a really important day.
You touched on it a little bit there about people's hesitancy, maybe because they thought it was developed too quick. But as long as science has been a thing, there has been this hesitancy and this fear amongst certain people about it at this stage.
Yeah.
And we're seeing it now with like the anti-vax movement, and particularly in places like the United States. Where do you think these fears stem from? Like, why do they keep coming up? And what is it that people like yourself are doing, or like politicians can do to try and ease those fears?
Yeah, I think there's two types of people. I mean, there's the people who are genuinely hesitant, and that's very understandable because it's a new disease, it's a new vaccine. There's always a level of reluctance in a population, and that's completely understandable. It's been there ever since vaccines were invented. Like, who wants to stick a needle into a baby's arm who's got no disease? You know, it's a big thing to do for a parent, for example. And then there's all these horror stories on the web. You read them, even though they're rare, that'll feed into people's fear as well, you know, and it's all completely understandable. And all you can do is just be fully transparent, get the information out as clearly as we can, and say, look, if you're still uneasy, talk to your GP, listen to people who you might trust. That might include me for some people, but, you know, in other words, you got to go to people who you trust. And even then you mightn't want to vaccinate, and it's your choice. It should be a free choice, you see. Now, then there's the other extreme where there are anti-vaccination campaigns and they would be quoting many studies and all the rest of it. It's very hard to counter any of that really in a rational way, I don't think. And if you do counter it, you give it oxygen. And to me, it's, as a scientist, it's very simple. It's all about data. That's the only thing that should drive this debate, is data. And if someone has data to support what they're saying, fantastic, show me that data. I'll show you mine. In a normal scientific conference, I'll get up and give a talk, and there might be two or three people at the microphone trying to put the boot in a very objective way. And they might say, oh, I've got data different to you. I said, well, great, show it to me, because I want to get to the truth, you know? And then we'll sit down and look at our data, might collaborate. Sometimes you don't agree. So, but it's always data-driven. You can't make a statement about anything as a scientist unless you can back it up with data as much as you can. Now, sometimes you got to make statements based on prediction, perhaps. Stuff like that happens, and I do that. We all have to do that a bit. But by and large, if someone says, I think vaccines are evil, I'll say, that's a good, I hear you, show me the data. You know, and they'll give me their data. I'll have a look at it, and then I'll show them mine, and then hopefully either I'll convince them, unlikely, or we just leave it there, you know. But it's hard, yes, it's a tricky one. Mm.
This is a politics show, so we're going to swing you closer to maybe some of the politicky questions that are going to come up around the vaccine. And one of the one that has been a big thing over this weekend, at least, has been who gets what and who should have access to the vaccine and when.
Yeah.
So in terms of making those decisions, do you think it should be weighed more in terms of political concerns, or is there like scientific, like much more clear scientific guidelines that maybe the politicians aren't using as much?
I wouldn't bring policy into it at all. It shouldn't be any politics in this at all. It should be purely based on practicalities, is the word I would use here. And you start with the mission, and the mission is to vaccinate everybody in the country. Let's start with that, right? If I could wave my magic wand and do it now, we won. I can't, because it's not as simple as that. And then you say, right, let's go for the more risk, well, those at risk first. Makes everything's common sense based, remember, as well. So healthcare workers, over 70s, and then the care home people, then everybody over 70, and then we begin going down through the ages. It's as simple as that. Now, where the politics might come in is, oh, should teachers be vaccinated ahead of, you know, fire engine drivers or farmers or pilots on planes, that kind of thing, you know. Now, that's a tricky one. I don't envy them trying to put a list of orders there, because everybody would have their own desire for this, I suppose. So I think overall then the answer to all of this, and it's a bit like the answer overall to when this started, you know, science gets us out of it. The vaccine is there. Get us as many arms as we can, as quickly as we can. And the reason why we have to do it in groups is because of the supply issue. Now, once we get to May, June, July, supply won't be an issue then. We reckon there'll be loads of vaccines for everybody. And it's just a case of getting people up and getting them vaccinated, you see. So this business of the AstraZeneca vaccine, that was a sensible enough thing to say, because the data from the Pfizer trial included people over 65. AstraZeneca didn't. So if you've enough of the Pfizer one, use that in the over 70s. But I've no doubt that AstraZeneca data will come out, I bet, tomorrow. Now, there's a bet, lads. We can put money on it. This week, AstraZeneca will release data showing their vaccine works in the over 65s. So that's the end of that one then. I know that can be used in older people as well. So it's amazing how it's a day-by-day thing, isn't it, in a way? You know,
yeah.
We get very het up for 2 or 3 days. And then it goes away because the thing moves on and the science takes a step further, you see, in the right direction. So those are the sorts of thoughts I have about the vaccine rollout. I mean, equitable access is critical, of course. Get it to the most people in as quickly a time in each category as we can, you know. And then the other bit of this, it moves on more globally into the developing world. We got to get the vaccine to those countries as well. And that's the next big challenge, by the way, because obviously enough, you know, there's issues about supply there and who has priority and so on. So, but these are very important questions for, say, the world as a whole.
Mm. Speaking of that, the WHO is mounting a bit of a campaign to tell Western countries that hoarding vaccines will come back to bite them.
Yeah.
In terms of new resistant variants. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's very sensible. Well, the WHO has a campaign to vaccinate the developing world, not just for COVID. You know, for the WHO has done a fantastic job over the years. I mean, we've almost got rid of polio now. It's gone from Africa. And it's almost going to be gone from the world. I mean, that'll be the second virus we'd have fully conquered. And the reason why it's so important is because if it's in a developing world country and it's gone from Ireland and gone from Europe, there's always a chance of coming back. It's a source to seed infection back into us. And then we might be in a difficult place again, you see. And that's one reason to do it, apart from the social equity reason that everybody should be vaccinated anyway. The second thing that happened, I saw last week, was a huge economic report, which said if we don't vaccinate those countries, it'll cost $9 trillion to the world economy. Oof. And that was based on supply chain problems, first of all, because many products come from those countries. And then secondly, this risk of reintroduction, giving rise to other economic damages, you see, in them more developed countries. So the case is being made very strongly and very vocally to say, let's keep that developing world agenda very much in our minds. And that's exactly what we should do.
But do you think, I mean, this is probably a more political question, but do you think there would, like, how would Joe Biden or Micheál Martin or Boris Johnson be able to say, okay, we will slow down the vaccination of our country to share the vaccines? Like, can a politician be brave enough to be able to do that? I guess maybe if enough scientific voices were to back them up, then.
Yeah, they might. I mean, once we've done the vulnerable, remember, I mean, once we've got all the people vaccinated who are in the older age groups who've got underlying diseases, they're the two groups that we look at. Once they're done, and the 700,000 of them in Ireland in total, right? Everybody else is at very low risk of disease, remember? And 99% of people, their immune systems work great and they fight this virus, you see. It's only this small number that get really sick, you see. So there may well be a push. Once we've protected that group, we can now slow down a bit, as you say, the other groups, perhaps, if the developing world has a real problem with vaccines. That'd be a big political decision, wouldn't it? I think but I would be looking at that because as I say, the chance of someone in their 30s and 40s catching this virus and getting really ill is tiny anyway, you know? So the need for them to be vaccinated is a lot less then. Whereas in the developing world, you might have lots of people over 65 who are just as vulnerable as anybody in our countries. And so you might even have a global campaign of priority lists where the whole world begins with the healthcare workers and the vulnerable and the elderly. And then once they're all done all over the world, you move into the next ages. That might possibly happen. I mean, one argument against that is if we get to 80% immunity in Ireland, the virus has gone away then, you know? You've got to get to 80% to get really profound effects on spread. And that's obviously the plan they've got in place, you know. And that could still be the stated plan, but you could provide a bit of extra vaccine. If a country like in the developing world was desperately in need of some vaccines. Maybe we'll give up, if we vaccinate everybody over 30, we might say, okay, you guys over 20, just wait another 3 weeks, because right? We're going to give it to this other country over here. Wouldn't that be a lovely thing to say? I hadn't thought of that. That's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, young podcasters aren't really on the top of the list. I think Steve and I can give up our ones and pass them over.
Right. We're not going to get them for a very long time. We're okay with that.
And rightly so. So speaking more broadly, like you're touching on there, this big important issue that is being advocated by the scientific community and the WHO in general. How important is it, do you think, for scientists to get involved in this kind of public discourse? And how important is it for the experts to, take some time to get away from the labs and actually go out and do some advocacy?
I think it's very important for scientists to communicate with the public. Let's start with that. And that's important for all kinds of reasons. I mean, first of all, the taxpayer pays for my lab, so I'm obliged to tell the taxpayer what we're doing. Let's start with that one, and then secondly, it's kind of our job in a way to communicate, because people want to know, and we're the ones to go out there and tell them. So they're the kind of two things that are always in my mind. Now not everybody can. And then the third thing is, of course, to provide advice to the government and to various bodies using our scientific know-how. I'm not a huge fan of scientists commenting on, say, public policy in relation to, should we open the pubs type stuff, because often there isn't enough science to inform that. So scientists should be reluctant, really. You get drawn into it. I've been asked to come on, I've done it, but it's always a bit of a sense of unease because there's not enough data there. And remember the three key things that every scientist must remember when they're in the media. It's very simple. One is, it's not about you, okay? So don't think you're doing, this is Luke O'Neill on the radio here. It's not about you at all, right? That's the first thing. Secondly, if you don't know the answer to something, say it. Say, I don't know. That's really important. And then thirdly, just speak about things from the point of view of data. They're the three things. And if you keep those in mind, you won't go far wrong, And when it's the first one, it's not about me. If people stop listening to me or my voice is too often on the radio, which is the case, I should stop doing it because people stop listening, The reason you do it is to get the information out there as clearly as you can, and it can't be about you, So it can be a little bit tricky then, because, I was pressing a lot for more diversity to get more. They kept asking me, every day I'd have three or four. I'm not joking. I still have every day two or three requests. And I said, no, ask this other person, ask that person, And we need a balance of voices from the scientific community. It can't just be one. Because, as I say, mainly because people do stop. If my voice has gone on the radio, so I ask that guy again, he turns off,
Do you think it's a personality thing? Do you think that maybe perhaps science just attracts more people that aren't as comfortable speaking out and doing that?
Well, in the early days, when I began doing this first, you'd be slagged off by our fellow scientists, Oh, who do you think you are? This kind of thing. You're full of your own, whatever, and there you are in the media. So the community itself, there would be a bit of negativity towards scientists. And I would defend that by going, I'm doing it just because I'm being asked and I can explain things to people I want to hear, So that's one aspect. But the second thing is, not everybody can do it, and that's fine. It's not essential to be able to do it. If you're a scientist, you may have six different skills. Let's say your best skill of all is being a fantastic scientist, but you're hopeless in the media. That's perfectly fine. Just keep doing your thing. Maybe 10% of us should be doing it. And certainly you don't want people doing it who can't do it or aren't able for it or not good at it. That'll backfire then, because there's a global mission here in a way,
Yeah, who's going to trust the sweaty guy whose voice keeps breaking and it looks like he's going to be himself.
Yeah. So I never criticize my colleagues who won't do it. I encourage them to do it, especially younger ones. I think it's very important to get them out and trying to do it. And then if they say nah, I say fine, that's okay. So it's kind of an interesting thing. I mean, the other thing to tell people is, if they do it, they'll enjoy it. It's actually a very rewarding thing to do, because people do like us scientists providing information. It turns out we help them, So it's a really good one in that regard.
And then on that, when you go out there and put the data forward and back it up with science and think, okay, there you go, I've made my contribution to the policymakers, and they're going to go off and do the right thing. But then you read the next day that they go, yeah, no, we chose not to do that anyway. How frustrating can that be? Is it harder then to go out the next day and try and lobby again for the right thing if you know that it's just going to fall onto deaf ears?
No, it's disappointing. I was an early advocate for masks. Very early on, I was banging on about masks. And I wrote a great piece, I thought, for the Independent. I said, now, tomorrow the government will change their nothing. You could hear a dog bark.
You know? What do you think? What do you think was like? Actually, that's a good one. So like, there's been like we're probably not going to know for a year or two. But do you think at the top level of government they were like, we know masks will work, but we don't have enough to go around, so we're going to have to pretend like it's not really science.
Yeah.
Do you think that was part of it?
I think it takes guts, actually, is really any of these things, you know? And there were one or two unknowns. Like one was all the PPE masks get used up, say, and not available, or it'll be litter everywhere, you know, this kind of thing. And then another worry they had was the data wasn't that strong. Now, they were right. Back in February, that was the case. And the reason why I changed my mind on this myself was I saw the data coming out. And in fact, lots of research was done in February and March, really convincing research that masks work, you see. And then I myself said, right, I'm going to make a strong recommendation based on that data. See, science has to be able to change. The whole purpose of science is to move things forward and to change what we know or give us more knowledge on something. And masks were like that. So I think that they missed a beat because they didn't keep up with that science is one problem or one possibility, you know, and hadn't got it into their heads as clearly as we would have liked probably. But then eventually they themselves as medics and scientists had to say, yep, this works, let's go for it, you know. So it's a bit of a process. It just took a bit of time, I think, because it is a bit big enough thing for them to say, look, everybody wear masks for definite, you know. Because that creates consternation in various circles, you see. The second one that worries me at the moment is vitamin D. I'd love them to make a very clear recommendation on vitamin D. And it's a bit half-hearted. You know, last week, NPHET was asked to look at it by Leo Varadkar. And they came out with a statement saying, yeah, kind of, you know, or whatever the phrasing was. Mm-hmm. They didn't say everybody over 70 should be supplemented up to this dose. That's what I wanted, not just me.
I never heard of this one. Vitamin D is going to help fight COVID?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there was more and more evidence of vitamin D being beneficial.
Wow. Yeah.
And
I was looking around there because I have a bottle of vitamin D supplements because I was reading up on that.
There you have it.
Yeah, so I've been taking it every day. Yeah. Also, I read that they used to supplement, fortify margarine with vitamin D back before. Right. That, like someone was saying, making the point of maybe we can supplement our butter and stuff with vitamin D because it helps.
But especially in older people because they can't make enough and they're indoors a lot and stuff. And the evidence, and it's certainly harmless as long as you don't massively overdose, which you can give guidelines on. So I'm hoping they might get stronger on vitamin D. That's the aim. And again, it must be kind of a slight reluctance. You know, it's something that's there. I'm not quite sure. It seemed to be an easy win to me. For them to say we really think vitamin D will help older people, that can't be any negatives in that. So why they didn't make a more stronger recommendation, I don't know.
We're nearly done, but before we do, let's talk a little bit about funding, because it is so important. And you mentioned earlier about one of the things that really helped to drive the early vaccine efforts was just the near unlimited funding that was given to these companies. And in a similar vein, people often reference the near unlimited funding that was given by the US during World War II that led to all sorts of crazy innovations. Yeah. So if we apply that same kind of thinking to other problems that may, you know, that are just as imminent but aren't getting the same sort of attention, like climate change, rather than having governments like picking and choosing specific directives, is it just a matter of like, you know, throwing resources at this until we see what sticks?
Yeah, the money has to be targeted, obviously, in various ways. I'm heavily involved in this over the years. So I would be on grant awarding committees. I chaired the arthritis charity in the UK for years about how they give money to and how much do they invest in and spend their money on, you know. So it's always been there as a very important topic, obviously. And there's always a debate about the public versus private sector. So the privates should fund research and they don't do as much as they should. The public, the government, it is the government's job to support scientific research in every country. So the question always is how much and how should that be deployed in various ways. And Ireland, when I came back to Ireland after being working in the UK for years, there was hardly any money in Ireland for science. And my supervisor in Cambridge said to me, Luke, you're a bloody idiot going there. He says, it's a backwater. You know? But luckily, Science Foundation Ireland got going and they made a massive difference to Ireland. And then and that's why we could grow. I mean, Ireland now, we have in immunology, for instance, we're in the top 1 or 2% in the world based on performance. That couldn't have happened without money. You know, and the big analogy I use is it's like a football team, actually, where I'm the manager and I've got to recruit players, right? I need money to build the football stadium and attract them and then start winning things. And then you attract more and more better people. So it's very much money is very much tied into it for obvious reasons. Now, whether they should be spending even more, they should, because remember, if you fund research, it's insurance against the future, really, is what you're spending money on. So in other words, if another pandemic came, and luckily all that research that was funded for the past 30 years in immunology, that was the insurance fund to get us these vaccines, you know. And the same would apply into the future. And the big comparison, as you kind of alluded to, was always funding in war and funding you know, nuclear deterrence and all these sorts of things. They were all insurance against the future. We built loads of Martello towers in Ireland against the French. Not a single shot was fired from those towers, you know.
And now they're great Airbnbs. So,
yeah, that's right. So you know what I mean? So in other words, if you invest in research, it will help you deal with the things that are coming down the track. And climate change is the elephant in the room by far. And we all know this. And I saw a great cartoon of some guy looking at a microscope and there's COVID. And behind him is a massive elephant. Climate change. So I think that's the big one next to watch. And I think one thing I would hope for is that we've learned now that science has delivered on one huge crisis. We need science more than ever now to deliver on the climate change crisis. And that's everything from renewables to different ways of, you know, handling the environment, all that sort of stuff. And it's informed by data from scientists. So that's the big one. I think the two big areas, no doubt, will be climate change and then more biomedical stuff, because it's not just infectious diseases that we need to do work on. Remember, there's an epidemic of things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, you know. All those things need a lot of investment and research as well. So I think the future is very bright for science in that regard. And it is like after the Second World War, where billions went into physics because of the atom bomb success, you know.
Yeah. Were you pleased to see that last year's CEO applications had a huge spike for science related degrees and courses?
Yeah, that's great to see. Yeah. Now, the next thing we need to think about then is careers for these people. Sometimes you get loads coming into a university sector and there's no jobs for them afterwards. It's true, though. So that's another one to think about. But it's certainly that's evidence that that CIO thing is evidence that the science message has resonated with these young people. And I think what I'd say as well is they all want a mission at that age, remember. They all want to do something that's got meaning. I mean, what could be more meaningful than trying to work on COVID-19 or cancer or all these diseases you see in my area? There's other parts of science equally meaningful, of course.
Yeah. Well, I think the type of advocacy you're doing now is, you know, partly responsible for this like newfound appreciation. And so I guess thank you for all the great work you've been doing in Ireland. I know this is the most exciting my family's ever been for a guest we've had on the show.
Oh, good Lord.
Because everyone's, again, your book did very well, especially in the Nolan family, and your work on News Talk and stuff has really permeated the Nolan clan. And I know it has good many stuff. Other households in Ireland. So thank you again for all you've done. And
no worries.
Continue
very
to
happy
do.
To do it. And what's happening to me is interesting. I get about one or two emails a day asking me to record a little clip, me going, "Happy birthday, Mary." Which I'm very happy to do. It takes 2 seconds. Yeah. That's easy to do.
Oh, that's adorable.
That's lovely. You should just do a bank. You sit down someday with like the phone book and say every name, happy birthday, and you just have a Dropbox. And you just send out links. There you go.
Lift the nation.
There you go. That's it. Luke, thank you so much for this. This has been wonderful.
No problem.
Enjoy the rugby.
And it'll help your immune system if we win.
See you, Luke.
I don't know if we had the episode there, but when Steve and I initially arranged this interview with Luke, it conflicted with the rugby.
Yeah.
So the man is full package. He's, you know, a sports appreciating jock, but also an incredibly intelligent scientist.
Yeah.
He's exactly. More than will ever be, Steve, is what I'm saying.
Well, I mean, we didn't even know the rugby was on.
I know, that's it.
So
that's what
we're not scientists and we don't know the rugby is on. So we've got nothing going for us.
I was about to say, but we're podcast. But he's got his own podcast and it's very good.
He's got his own podcast too.
there'll be links to Professor Luke's socials and his podcast and his various endeavours in the show notes below. But great, we've got the inside scoop that he's working on a new book.
I was just about to say, keep an eye out for that book. That's going to be awesome. That'll be like,
yeah.
I mean, we're going to spend so much time reading books about what happened, but like this kind of thing, like a day by day as it happened, kind of with scientific insight, would be really handy.
Yeah, yeah. Keep an eye out for that. That's great. I had no idea that was in the works.
Hopefully we're allowed to tell people. Oh, well.
Oh, well. Look, we'll release it. And if we get a cease and desist, then we'll know.
Then we'll know.
Won't we? Then we'll know. Thank you for listening. What I'm Politics on Instagram and on Twitter. whatimpolitics@gmail.com if you want to shoot us an email. And what else we got, Steve?
We have a few bonus episodes in Headstuff Plus. If you follow the link in the show notes there, you can go. It is only €5 plus VAT, value added tax. But I'm telling you, you will already have loads of value. So that's why it's so highly taxed. It's actually, sorry, it's not that high of VAT. It's like an extra euro or something. But we just have to say. Yeah. 5 plus VAT. If you are subscribing, you can click on the What Am Politics little picture, and that means that we'll get all the money. So if you're only going to support us, do that. But if you are going to support other Head Stuff people, you can click them too. But just know, if you are doing it, you don't have to click everyone. If you just want to support us, you can just click our picture.
Yeah.
And you'll get all our bonus stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we'd really, really appreciate it. But that, I think that's it.
I think that's about it.
I think that's about it.
Is that about it?
You should be taking vitamin D.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah. You should.
In general, because of COVID?
Well, I think during the winter months, I know the NHS, I got into it because the NHS was just has a blanket recommendation even before COVID
for the
winter
colds
months.
And flus.
Yeah, exactly, because it boosts your immune system. Like, you get it from the sun. But
I take Pharmaton every day since I got old. Is that like...
What's that?
It's like one of the multivitamins with a bit of ginseng in it to give you a kick.
Ah,
and then this guy called Pharmaton comes around and gives you a kick. In the teeth
while you're snorting it.
Yeah.
look at the back of it. There's usually like,
they'll probably just say 100% sugar. They actually smell like chocolate. I think I'm just swallowing little chocolates without chewing them.
Christ. But yeah, take your vitamin D, people. There you go. You heard it from Luke himself.
It'd be awful if the science changes and that we're actually poisoning everybody, because that's my understanding of how science works.
This is how fucking fake news starts. I heard on a podcast that vitamin D is poison.
Luke O'Neill was on the podcast. He was a part of when they were...
Luke O'Neill was on that podcast, and somewhere on that podcast, I don't know where, I heard that it was poison.
He definitely wasn't part of the conversation, and we'll caveat that. And we probably should cut this, but we won't because it's funny. And that's how lies start.
Yeah.
Sorry, Luke.
Just listen to science, people. Listen to science.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com. That's
Banging with Chris and Marcus. Hello, my friends, and welcome to That's Banging with me, Marcus O'Lara.
And me, Chris Mellon.
A new podcast celebrating everything good from farm to plate,
ship to service,
and field and fork.
A celebration of everything tasty, fresh and excellent that's coming off our island at the moment.
As well as interviews with people who are shaping the best of the best of food and drink from around the country. We'll be available on Apple Podcasts,
Spotify,
and everywhere else you get your podcasts.